Okay, thanks for coming. This is the final lecture in Informatics 1DA. You should have a course questionnaire sheet though by the doors, and if you didn't get one, you can pick one up on the way out. This is standard school questionnaire. Okay, so the standard one is on the web. You can fill it out online if you'd rather. It then goes into the database automatically. Or you can fill it out on paper here and leave it either on the desk at the end of the lecture or take it up to the ITO. These are read by at least me, also the year organizer, and they're then passed on, and particularly if any questions are raised, they go further to various committees and to the head of school. So please do fill out the questionnaires. This is a really good way for us to get any kind of feedback from you on how things have gone. If you'd rather do it online, then you can do that as well. Or if you think of something else and you'd like to put a comment online, then do that afterwards. I will try, depending on time, to give you some time at the end of this lecture to fill this out. Experience shows that although filling things out online is somehow easy and quick and you could do it any time, typically we don't. You don't and I don't. And having a fixed time to do it, like sitting here, but you probably haven't got a pencil, I should provide those as well, is a reasonable way to get a number of people to give the responses they always had meant to give but never got around to sometime. So please fill it out. There are four sides. That's only long because I've given lots of space for you to write comments in. Don't feel bad about leaving it blank. You don't have to answer every question. Again, it's entirely anonymous. If you'd rather not hand it in here, you can take it to the ITO, you can give it to somebody else to hand in, or you can do it online, which isn't tracked. Thanks. But please do fill things out. It's really useful for us. So last time we talked about, there you go, there should be supplies on the desks there. Have we run out over there? Okay, there's some more there if anyone's sure. So we've been doing statistical testing, and I'm going to do chi-squared test today, which you will have already seen in tutorials. I'll go a little bit into when you can apply it and the background to it and give some examples. The specific application in the lecture slides is to identify collocations in text. Remember, when you've got a large body of text and you're doing analyses and you think, well, maybe this phrasing is unusual to this author or this text or this language, and you can say, well, yes, a certain phrase appears often, but is that surprisingly often? Is that unusually often? Is that more often than in other texts and so on? And how do you measure that? And chi-squared test is one way to do that. But it's also useful in all kinds of other testing. Are we? I can't see anything here. So we had the correlation coefficient, which was about showing whether some numerical data, one numerical value is correlated with another, whether we could draw a straight line through lots of dots in a scatter chart. And that's useful, but it's only useful if, for correlation, if you have numerical data, either an interval or a ratio scale, if you've got numbers, if you're measuring people's heights or their marks in an exam or the length of time they've spent at the university or something like that. You need a number. But remember, we had several different kinds of scale of data. We might have exact numerical data. We might have approximate numerical data. We might have ranking data, which isn't numerical. It just says where somebody came in the class, perhaps, or whether you have an ordering. One grade is higher than another, but by how much isn't really recorded. Or we might just have categorical scales where we just put things into a number of bins. And this is where the chi-squared test comes in. If you've got categorical data, where you've got a number of people or cities or towns or objects of some kind, you know, things coming off a production line, and you don't have numerical data, you just have classification, things coming off a production line were satisfactory or they were broken when tested in some way. Or people come from one of a range of countries, or cities do or do not have a university. Something where you can just put things into categories, but there's no numerical data attached to it. And the chi-squared test is about investigating correlations between categorical data, whether something being in one category is correlated with it being in another, whether cities that have universities have railway stations, for example, or something like, in this case, we're going to look at, if you have class students enrolled on a course, did they turn up for the exam, and did they hand in any coursework? So you might think that handing in coursework or not is a predictor for whether somebody's going to turn up to the exam. And that might or might not apply if the coursework was or wasn't related to the final grade. So for example, in this course, tutorials, it's tutorials attendance and the tutorial work you do doesn't count towards your final credit, but one might speculate there'd be a correlation between people who did do the tutorial work or did it well, and whether or not they even turned up to the exam.
On the other hand, there might not be a correlation. It might be that people aren't doing the coursework because they're already immensely experienced in the field and they're just going to turn up to the exam and pass and no trouble. Or it might be that the pressures are different, that during term time, pressures, some of you are doing joint degrees where maybe the other degree is putting a lot of pressure on you to do lots of work that's handed in and is worth a lot to the final result, so you spend all your time on that. But when the exam time comes, actually it's even between the courses and you turn up to all the exams. So there might be such a correlation, it's reasonable to investigate it, but you need to look at the numbers to see whether there is. And we'll follow the usual idea of a statistical test, which we discussed last time. We make a null hypothesis. The default is to assume nothing special, and then try and show that there's enough surprise in the data to show that actually we can reject the null hypothesis, something is happening, and you can then go investigate what it is that's happening. And the chi-square test will allow us to calculate the probability that the data we've got could in fact occur just by random chance. That if the null hypothesis were true, there were no correlation between anything we've got, that the numbers we got would in fact just turn up. And if p is really low, as in the data we see is really, really unlikely to occur if the null hypothesis is true, then we reject the null hypothesis and say there is something going on. There is a correlation between these two things. So remember, we had that with the linear regression. We'd have lots of points scattered over a chart. You could look at it and say, oh, I think there's a line there. But that's not the same as having a test. Well, is it really there? Would somebody else looking at it agree on that? Would several of you come back with the same information? And so you work out what's the probability that we see them cluster like that just by chance? And then you look up and see, well, is it going to happen with 5% probability, 1% probability, 10% probability? OK, so the chi-square test you apply to what's called a contingency table. And this is where you're taking the data, the things that might be correlated, and you're classifying them according to whether they fall into one or other categories. And this contingency table is two-way, and we record whether students submitted or did not submit their work, and whether they attended or did not attend tutorials. So we've got these two things, two classifications, not numeric, they're just saying whether somebody falls into one bin or another, one category or another, and we conjecture they might be correlated. So the null hypothesis, they're uncorrelated, we're looking for evidence to show that that's untenable, that there is something else going on there. Of course, we're not in advance saying whether the correlation is that people who don't turn up to, don't hand in their tutorial work means that they're really guilty about that and they turn up to the exams, or the other way around, whether because they're not here at all, in fact, and they're not going to turn up to either. We're just looking for any difference from the uncorrelation. So here we have the contingency table. The four different contingencies are students who submitted coursework and attended the exam, students who did not submit coursework but still attended the exam, students who submitted coursework but didn't attend the exam, and students who didn't submit coursework or attend the exam. So there are four categories, and we'll count the number of students that fall into it. So this, for a course, I think this may actually be real data from a previous incarnation of this course, but suggests that 94 of the students, so most of the students did the coursework, turned up for the exam, fine. 20 students did not submit the coursework but still turned up to the exam. 15 students didn't submit coursework and didn't turn up to the exam. And there are two students who submitted all their coursework but didn't turn up to the exam. So you might say, well, that's sort of skewed slightly, but exactly, this is not as visual, it's not as easy to pick up as, say, the scattergraph data, the numerical data where you could look at it and say, I think there's a curve or a line here. You might visualize this in various ways to do with blocks or arrows or vectors. But either way, you want more than a visual impression. You want some numerical backing up. And whereas in the case of linear regression, the advantage of the mathematical method would be to that we spot patterns all the time, we would likely see, oh, there's a curve, there's a line, there's something there. And the numerical analysis would tell you whether actually that is significant or whether this is just you trying to find patterns in things. In this case, this is the other way around, in a sense. We've got a pile of numbers. This is a small table, but a contingency table. If you're looking for a correlation between things that fall into five different categories against eight other different categories, you might have quite a large table, lots of numbers. And typically, you'll have no intuition for whether something's going on there. You'll just see lots of numbers and say, well, that looks interesting. And the advantage of the numerical analysis is that even in this sea of numbers, that can pick out whether or not there's something going on that you can't see directly. So the observations are what we call the actual data. What we're going to do is compare those to saying, well, what would we expect to see in this table if, in fact, there were no correlation at all? If attendance and attending the exam and submitting coursework were completely uncorrelated, what would we expect to see here? Well, we'd expect to see the same number of students, for example. We'd expect the totals in here to add up to the total number of students. And we'd somehow expect the proportions to be even, that the proportion who submitted and didn't submit will be the same whether or not they attended the exam. So we'd want it to be kind of no correlation between them. And that's what we'll do is we'll calculate the expected frequencies, the frequencies you'd expect to see if that same number of students were attending or not attending exams at the same rate, submitting and not submitting coursework at the same rate, but they weren't correlated. And then you compare. You've got a table of observed, your table of expected, and you say, are the observed frequencies different to the expected ones by some significant amount? And if they're very different, then we reject the null hypothesis. We say there is a correlation. And if they're not that different, then we don't. So the way to calculate the expected ones is to be these so-called marginals. They're called marginals because you write them in the margin of the table. So the marginals are the subtotals. They're saying, well, of all the students, how many submitted their coursework, irrespective of whether they turned up to the exam? How many didn't turn up to an exam, irrespective of whether they submitted their coursework? So you add them up, and then you get the total number of students. So that's what they are in this case. They'd say total number of students, total number of who did submit coursework, didn't, and so forth. And then, once we've got the marginals, these ones around the edge, we can say, well, supposing those stay fixed, supposing we don't change the total number who submitted and we don't change the total number who attended, then how many would we expect in each of these four subcategories? So that would be if there was no correlation at all, if submitting your coursework and attending the exam were unconnected. And the way you do that is to multiply the marginals and divide by the total. And this gives you, I mean, it looks rather unwieldy, but what it's doing actually is just the kind of thing you'd expect. It's arranging that the proportions between these are the same. So actually the numbers are there. The expected values here are, so this is saying, supposing of the 114 students who attended, it's not related at all to whether or not they submitted their coursework. And we know that 96/131 of students submitted coursework, so we'll just take 96/131 times 114, and we get this. So these are the expected ones. If we say the ratio here will be the same as the ratio there and the ratio there, and similarly between attendance and not attendance, we're going to say about 1731 of the student body didn't attend the exam, and that would give this ratio here. So we construct the expected one saying we assume there's no correlation in the table, and then we want to compare these two. And the question is this table at the top different to this table at the bottom? Well, it's got integers and that's got fractions in. Some of these figures are larger than those, some are smaller than those, but are they a lot smaller or a lot larger? And this is what chi-squared calculates. So chi-squared is calculated by taking the difference between the observed and the expected, squaring it, which makes it positive, and then dividing by the total value you'd expect. In that, for each of the four cells, the ones we filled in, we calculate, subtract that from that, square it, and divide by the expected value, and then add them all up. Again, we square because mathematically it gives good behavior. If we took the modulus of it, if we just said ignore the sign, then it will be much harder to predict the expected distribution of this, and so whether the value we got back was unlikely, and mathematically it doesn't behave as well. There's also, this doesn't scale with magnitude particularly well. So at the top we've got a squared value, and at the bottom we've just got the expected number. So somehow the unit for the top of here is students squared, and the unit on the bottom is students. So the total sum has a unit, chi-squared has a value of students. So if we multiplied all the figures in the table by 10, we would get a different chi-squared value. We get a value that was 10 times larger. And that's because this is not, although these are numbers, they're not measuring a thing. They're not measuring the marks in something or the length of something. They're counting the number of individuals in there. And if there were more individuals, if we were dealing with 10 times as many students, then we would expect, we'd expect less random variation. What we're doing is saying, could the variation we see here arise randomly? And that depends on how many there are. If there are a lot of students, then you'd expect not much random variation. If there's a small number of students, then you might get an apparent correlation just because there's a small number and a few of them have randomly gone one other way. So this figure, it's crucially depends on the total number of objects. It's not a size or a mark or a measure. It only works for categorical data. So in this case, we can compute it, we can calculate the, subtract the values, square them, and divide. And we get the value 37.76, which is that a big number? Is that a small number? So this is where some rather elaborate mathematics comes in to say what the expected value would be, given a 2 by 2 by to table with these kind of numbers in, how large would you expect the chi-squared to be? And these things are computed and then assembled in tables. They're also generally available on spreadsheets as functions where you can say, perform the chi-squared test for this block of data against this block of data. Here are the expected values, here are the observed values. These are the ones for a 2x2 contingency table. These are the relevant critical values. The chance of chi-squared being over 2.7 in if the null hypothesis is true is 10%. The chance of it being bigger than 10 is 1 in 1,000. And we had a value of 37. So the chance of this top table arising when we'd expect the bottom table is is less than 1 in 1,000. So we could, that's reasonable evidence to reject the null hypothesis and say these are in some way correlated. It's not just that this is the expected one, and on this particular run of it, we got these values here. Because it's clear that we'd definitely not expect to get these values because they involve small fractions of a student not turning up to an exam. And we can't actually measure the fact you're only half there in an exam. So we'd expect some variation, and we'd expect anyway there is chance in here. But it's a question of whether there's a lot, whether there's an unexpected amount. In this case, yes, there's the chance of this happening, the probability of this happening just by chance is 1 in 1,000. On the other hand, if we were to apply this statistic to all of the exams and all of the courses over several years, we would expect to see this once in a while, if once we started looking at the results for 1,000 different courses. So it's still best to be aware of the context in which this is happening. So in this case, we reject the null hypothesis with great deal of confidence. So there is a strong support for correlation between coursework submission and exam attendance. Actually, you then have to go back and say, well, is it a positive correlation? And in this case, I think it is, because for people who didn't submit their coursework, there's a higher chance than just under half didn't attend the exam, whereas if they did submit the coursework, almost all of them attended the exam. So there is a correlation, and it's a positive correlation. Which is kind of what you'd expect, but it's, and notice the ordering here, that we made the null hypothesis. We said, we're looking to see if there's a correlation between exam attendance, coursework submission and exam attendance. We don't necessarily know it's causal. We kind of suspect that if there is a cause, it's forwards, right? It's that students who didn't attend a coursework didn't attend the exam. It's less likely to be backwards in time. Students who don't attend the exam didn't previously do the coursework. But it might be that it comes from a common cause. We might speculate there is some reason that something that distinguishes students who don't submit coursework and don't attend the exam, and it's arising from both of those, it might be that because they didn't attend the coursework, didn't submit the coursework, they think, oh, I don't really know this. I might as well not go to the exam. I'm not going to do very well. Now, those are completely different scenarios, and our data doesn't provide anything to distinguish between those, whether it's coming from some other common cause or whether one element we're observing is directly observing the other. All we can say is that they're correlated. We might have further hypotheses to test about why this is the case or what's giving the cause to it, but that would require further tests. And you possibly couldn't do it using this data you've already used because you've already sucked out all of its significance in saying there is a correlation. So this is an important part of the statistical testing. You say what you're going to test, and then you get the data, or look at the data, and see whether or not you can reject your hypothesis. Once you start going over the same data again, it's possible, but you have to be aware that this is what you're doing. You can't, in general, take a large amount of data and go on a fishing expedition to see can we find some correlation. Though, of course, that's exactly what I do in these lectures to find examples, is go fishing through data to find correlations. Best not to go down that one. Other things about the chi-squared test. Here we had a 2x2 correlation table where there were four values. And so there's a sense in which how much this can vary by chance from the expected ones depends on how many numbers there are, actually. If we had a really big table, so those are observed values, we calculate some expected ones, we do chi-squared, then you think, well, actually, the chi-squared is going to be larger because there are 12 values to differ here, and we were adding those 12 terms. And also, there's somehow more opportunity for variation here because we could be different in this cell, and so on in all of them. And those are called degrees of freedom. But there isn't complete freedom to vary. In the case of the 2x2 cell, actually, when one changes, that forces all of the others because we're keeping the row and the column totals the same.
Similarly, in a larger square here, fixing the value there doesn't force all of the others, but once we've fixed two in a column, then you know what the third one's going to be. Or if you fix three in a row, you know what the fourth one's going to be. So in this case, actually, we only have 6 degrees of freedom. So in anything where we're measuring using the chi-squared test, we're saying, here are some boxes, essentially. It doesn't have to be tables. Chi-squared test can be used on any collection where you are classifying things, and you have some reason, some null hypothesis to expect certain values in the boxes, and you actually observe other values. But you have to say, well, how constrained are the values in those boxes? Must they all sum to some total? Must they all be in certain ratios? Must some sub-portions, like rows or columns, sum to certain values? And so you then say, does the chi-squared test show significant variation from what was expected, given the number of degrees of freedom available? The entries, so for a table, for an n by n contingency table, there is n minus 1 times n minus 1 degrees of freedom. Because once you've done all but one of a row, the final value of the row is fixed, because we're saying that we want the totals here, or the marginal values, to stay fixed. We were saying categorization along this axis and categorization along that axis are independent. So for a 2x2 table, you have 1 degree of freedom. And that means there's only one thing really that can vary here, but then that's the amount of randomness you expect. So if you look at a chi-squared table done by several degrees of freedom, it'll be clear that for a large number of degrees of freedom, much higher values of chi-squared can actually happen just by chance. So the critical values will be larger for larger degrees of freedom. So if there's only 1 degree of freedom, then any variation at all is perhaps surprising. The other thing is reliability. So I mentioned this issue that we had fractional values here. And so if we're expecting a value of 12.458, we're never going to get that. We're not going to get that number as our attendance number. It's going to be a whole number. And because this is not, we're not measuring numerical data, we have individuals we're putting in categories, and then we're looking to see how many are in that category. It's always going to be an integer. And so some amount of variation, that kind of, that a half there, at least a half, it may be up to a half, can occur without any randomness at all. It's just built into it. And so a certain threshold of the chi-squared is always going to be there. That's taken into account. And for large, if you have large values in these cells, then it's not so significant. But if you have only very small values, then that extra half can be a significant part of the variation. If the values down here were 0.2, 0.3, whatever, then we'd expect a fair amount of it's almost completely swamped by that rounding. This is because the chi-squared distribution is actually an approximation to what happens based on a continuous distribution. We know that putting things into categories is actually working in integers, but the chi-squared test assumes a continuous real value distribution. So it's imprecise. And that imprecision becomes worse the smaller the total values in the cells are. So chi-squared test is generally considered less reliable when one of the expected values, any one of the expected values, not the observed values, the expected values is below 5. And there are arguments about this, actually, as to whether 5 really is just picked out of the air as being what's reliable, what's unreliable, and so on. Sometimes you can put a modification, the Yates correction, which is essentially saying, well, a variation of a half, we always expect. So you take the observed minus expected minus a half. But on the other hand, that's also a little bit overcorrecting, because some of the variation is due to correlation. So the Yates correction is a bit too eager and will lead you to rejecting, not finding correlations when they're really there. And then there are more precise tests, one due to Fisher, which take into account the integer nature of everything, but are much, much harder to compute. So in particular, we wouldn't expect you to calculate the actual table values directly. And then harder to explain as well. So one can be more and more precise. But being more precise doesn't necessarily help you get better data, and it doesn't necessarily help you discover the answer of why did this happen or what's the cause. So chi-squared is quite good numerically for identifying a correlation, and that only goes so far. You then have to ask, well, what's the cause behind it? What other data can I find out? So one can do more precise ones. If chi-squared tests are very, if the values in the expected cells are very small, if they're below 5, if lots of them are below 5, then actually you just don't have enough data to say. What you could do in that case is, if you've got some categorical data, is aggregate it. Supposing we're doing this across lots of courses, and some courses are just so small or have so few instances of people not handing in their work or not turning up to exams that we can't do a chi-squared test, then you could amalgamate them. You could say, well, let's look at all the informatics courses and all the engineering courses, or let's look at all the arts courses and all the science courses. And that way, if you amalgamate some boxes, you might get values over 5, and then you can usefully apply the chi-squared test. And that's a reasonable thing to do if you've got very low data, very low numbers, and so you can't get a reliable result. You amalgamate them, you might lose some significance, but at least you get a reliable test. Okay, the second application is about finding collocations, but I'll say a little bit first about the exam. Registry have published the exam timetable. The Informatics 1 exam timetable is on Saturday, the 7th of May, between 2:30 and 4:30. There's a search page where you can look for all the Informatics 1 exams, all the engineering exams, or any particular course. It's in Gym 3 at St. Leonard's Land, and you can find out more if you follow the link. This is off the blog. There's also a link on the course webpage. Do check that. Don't necessarily... Well, you should take my word for it that this is what it said quite recently on the registry website. But do check. I mean, a registry are very good at fixing these things in advance and then sticking to it. But it's still worth checking your courses for yourself. Don't trust somebody else just because they tell you, oh, I looked, it was this, it'll be fine. Do check for yourself when the time is. In fact, best is to check for yourself and then ask somebody else what they think it is. Advice about the exams. The exam will take the form it has last year. There are 3 questions, roughly on parts 1, 2, and 3 of the course, but that's not guaranteed. There may be cross-references. There may be references to other parts of the course inside any question. So the 3 questions, you should answer all 3 of them. The exam will last 2 hours. We don't intend our exams to be especially time-pressured. We're not looking to measure how well you can perform at extreme speed. We don't set questions that are so long you will never be able to finish them, and it's just a race to see who can finish how much of which ones. The idea is that you should be able to write down all the things you can reasonably do on the question, you are able to do on the question in the time available. That said, if you practice on past papers and past questions, then you will get faster. And this may be worth doing. It may be that you then feel you have enough elbow room to think about a problem to express it. So practice can help. Do look at past questions. The Informatics 1 course has been reasonably stable for the last 5 years, and so past questions are a good guide to future questions and a reasonable thing to test out what you've done. So do the past questions. They're available online. Practice doing them. Don't rely too much on... So that some of the past papers have so-called sample solutions attached. These are not as reliable as you might hope them to be. What they are, actually, they're not written as sample solutions. They're written as hints to the external examiner or to the person doing the marking or helping with the marking of the exams to indicate the kind of solutions, some of the difficulties students were anticipated to have, and so forth. In particular, they haven't been adjusted after the exam when we found out what actually students did write in their solutions, what variation, other possible solutions they came in with, and so on. And also there may be errors. That sometimes we go back and correct those, but it's not completely reliable. So if you find a past question and a solution that you think is maybe wrong, or you don't quite understand it, or you have a solution that's completely different, then don't assume that you're in the wrong, right? It's much more reliable to go and look at the lecture notes, or ask somebody else, or email. If you have problems, if you have a question about something, email me or Areti Manataki, who is the course TA. Personal web pages are both linked off the course web page. Write and say, I think there's a problem with this. You may be correct. So don't rely too heavily on past solutions. It's much better to do the question yourself and read through notes and find other resources. And that goes into reading around as well. Look back over the lecture slides, things you might have written on them, but also for much of the material that's in this course is standard in other computer science courses and as background material. So lots of the things that I've talked about, if you don't really understand the way I present it or the way it's been in the tutorial you've had in tutorial exercises or it's in the lecture slides, then go online, look for other references, ask other people for possible references, because there are these are
very standard techniques and standard things that you should be able to find out about elsewhere. Practicalities for doing the exam. Three questions. If you get stuck on the first question, go on to the second question. You know this applies to all exams, but you may forget it on the day. So write it down and look at it in the morning. This is really, really important. Lots of people do, every year, will get stuck on a particular part of a question, and it's kind of interesting, and it's annoying to be stuck, and so they'll spend far, far too much time working on that. Look at the marks allocated to things. Use that to guide how much time you spend on each of the questions through the exam. I think this is most of my comments on this. And do read the rubric. Your different exams from different courses will have different, the Informatics 1 DA, three questions, answer all three questions. Other courses may have different constraints. Please, please read the rubric. Even if you're pretty sure what it is, when you get into the exam, read the piece at the front to see it says what you expect. If it doesn't say what you expect, you could ask the invigilator about that. Because different courses will have different, there is some uniformity across them, across schools, but it's not absolute. It's really, really worth checking. Okay. And do look up all the exam tables for your course and get the timing balance, because different people, other people you know who appear to be doing similar courses, if they're doing some slightly different, that may completely change their revision schedule or their exam schedule. Do find out what your timetable is. Okay. Back to chi-squared. So we've got the test. Something else we can apply it to were this idea of collocation, sequences of words that occur atypically often. We had a corpus, the Dickens corpus. We could say, find adjectives and nouns that come together, tabulate them, find which adjective noun occurs most often. And sometimes those, we might feel that that's not because of chance or because of a particular piece of text, but is actually a unit in language. That strong T in particular was a particular example, or run amok. The verb amok, or is that an adjective? Anyway, amok only ever occurs with the verb run in front of it. And strong T is somehow more likely to be used than powerful T or something else. Some supposed synonym for strong would actually not mean the same when attached to T. And that's called a collocation. It's a language feature. And it's something to do with the kind of extension of the meaning of a word beyond its boundaries. Strong T is still two words. You can identify the adjective and the noun, but there is more weight to it than just the juxtaposition of the two. And one might conjecture that, but then you actually want to go out and look at some text and say, well, is that just your impression, or is it backed up by the data? Or is it perhaps backed up in some data, but not in others over time, for example? And we can use the chi-squared test to investigate this. So supposing we have a bigram, and we want to see, do they appear together atypically often? The contingency table is this one. So we're looking at bigrams where, so two words stuck together, and we say where the first word is or is not strong, and the second word is or is not T. So this is strong other things and other things T. So F, up here we have strong T, here we have completely unrelated pairs of words, and here we have strong and T paired up with other words. So in this case, strong desire. This is one that turned up in the list of most common bigrams in the Dickens corpus. But that might be because strong occurs a lot and desires occurs a lot. Or it might be because a strong desire is, in fact, a phrase that they're coupled together in the language. So this was one of the ones that was slightly surprising. Some of them came up, seemed unsurprising. They were to do with somebody's title or a name of a character that appeared. This is one you might think, well, that's kind of borderline. Is this a collocation or not? So here's a contingency table. Looking at pairs of words, strong desire turned up 10 times. Something desire turned up 214 times. Strong something turned up 655. And pairs that were neither strong nor desire turned up 3.5 million times. So the question is, well, is this number 10 big? And a reasonable way to do this is to do the chi-square test and say the null hypothesis is that strong and desire are not particularly coupled in any way. Strong occurs with desire at least as often as it occurs with anything else, given how often desire occurs in the text, and that similarly the other way around. And this, of course, depends on how often does desire turn up anyway, or strong. It might be that strong desire turns up a lot because actually They both words that are used a lot in the corpus, or one of them is.
So it's appropriate to the chi-square test, compute the marginals. The marginals are calculating just how common a word strong and desire is. And then you multiply them back in and say, well, assuming they're uncorrelated, how many occurrences would you expect? And you'd expect this number. And now the question is, well, is this table different to that table? The chi-square test,
the chi-square number is 2,000. That's enormous for a chi-squared.
And that's because essentially the expected number of strong and desire together is less than one, and we actually found 10. So if we're just mixing up words in the proportions they appear in the Dickens corpus, then strong and desire would occur together not at all. In fact, they occur together 10 times. So that's, okay, so that's coming together quite often. Null hypothesis, the significance value for a 1 in 1,000 would be 10. However,
the slight problem with this, actually, this is not, we accept that the Dickens corpus is not just a bunch of words thrown together randomly. We expect correlations in here. Nature is not, language is not random, and we'd expect, in English particularly, where word placement is important, we'd expect a strong correlation for almost any bigram that actually turns up. There is essentially no random mixing in the Dickens corpus. It's all carefully written by Charles Dickens. And so almost always, if two words appear together, that's because it's a sensible thing to do. So the critical values term is not actually that informative. All it's telling us is that this is from, and this will occur for any pair in the text, that this is from written language. This is why you can compress it efficiently, because if you know a sequence of words, it's really easy to guess which one of the 50 possibilities the next word is. It's why it compresses well, it's why you can analyze it. So can we see if it turns atypically often? Well, one way to do it actually would be to use the chi-square to rank the bigrams. And this is where we could start to see, is it unusually? So the question is not, does it occur often? Well, it occurs, yes. It's whether it occurs atypically often.
And so what you would have to do is you'd have to go through and find other collocation, other adjective-noun combinations, and say, well, how often do they turn up, and what's their chi-squared? And so the question is not, is this, are null hypothesis is not really that the Dickens corpus is a completely random set of words jumbled together. That's clearly not the case. But it's the hypothesis is, the null hypothesis would be that strong desire does not occur more often than any pair of words occurs, given that this is an English language text. So you should go through and look at other combinations, perhaps all the other ones that appeared in the top 50 common bigrams, and see how they occurred, whether they had, whether 2,000 is an atypically high chi-squared test. However, I'm not going to do this. The point is that chi-squared is a reasonable measure of how unexpected a collocation is. So this is kind of one layer upon another. We're extracting the chi-squared, and then we're using those to rank them. Finally, okay, so chi-squared is a reliable way of testing categorical data, data divided into categories. Say, here's what expected, and here's what we've actually got. And the table, is the contingency table, is a really common way of generating that expected data. There may be others. You may have arrangements where you have a certain set of things put in different categories or bins and some expected behavior, and the null hypothesis might not be that it's completely even. It might be that it goes linearly in some way, or that they're all collected on one side and you're comparing against that. But the table is the commonest, and it'll tell you whether what you're seeing is some kind of correlation. But correlation doesn't imply causation. And all that chi-squared is telling you, really, is if things go away from there being no correlation. So you can just say there's an effect there. What it is may be much harder to extract. And there's an example of this. So this is a famous case called the Berkeley sex bias case, which is, this is to do with admissions to the University of Berkeley to graduate school in 1973. These are the admission counts from the top four, the largest four faculties. So the original thing applied to the whole data for all of the university, but I'm cutting it down to the four largest faculties. And there were 3,228 people applied to these four faculties, of which 1,633 were accepted and 1,595 were rejected. So they accepted together about half of the people who applied. But if you were male and applying, your chance of being accepted was 53%, and female and applying, chance of being accepted was 46%.
And you can do a chi-squared test on these data. You can say, well, supposing there's actually no correlation here, supposing there is no sex bias in the selection at all, is there
would these figures occur just by chance?
And actually, the chi-squared value is 11.66, which is way below the 99.9% threshold, because essentially because you've got a lot of data here, and you would expect things to even out. So it's the chi-squared test allows you to reject with very high probability the hypothesis that there is no sex bias here. There is a sex bias in whether you're getting into Berkeley to do graduate study in 1973 if you're male or female. This was then the basis of a court case suing the university for sex discrimination, which is very strong legislation. The problem is that sex discrimination, at least at that time in that jurisdiction, required you to prove there was some kind of action happening. There was something. There was discrimination happening. It was not just that it was biased, not just that the figures were skew, but this was happening for a reason, that people were discriminating. They were admitting men rather than women. And in particular, admission to graduate school was not done, the selection was not done at a university-wide level. It was done at individual faculties. And so if you break it down by faculty, so these are the top four faculties. We can split them into faculty group S and faculty group A. S is roughly as a couple of science faculties, engineering. A is arts ones. And look at the division there. The idea, so we started from this. People then went to the, actually, over the whole university, there were 108 faculties doing admission, and they went through all 108 to see, well, which one is over-admitting men. But here's a gross breakdown between the sciences and the arts. We had 1,500 apply for faculty group S, 1,700 apply to faculty group A. And in faculty group S, if you're a man, your chance of getting in was 62%. If you're a woman, your chance was 80%. The chi-squared test gives 15. There's an overwhelming bias in favor of women. And in faculty group A, for arts, if you're a man, the chance of getting in was 35%. If you're a woman, the chance of getting in 42%. There was an overwhelming bias, significant, again, at the 1 in 1,000 level of being admitted if you are a woman. So, in fact, this is now significant enough to consider where there is a sex bias in selection in the science faculty and in the arts faculty, in both cases in favour of women. So this, the case evaporated because there was nobody to point to, which was really disconcerting. And this has then spawned a whole bunch of research about, well, what's going on here and so on. It's called Simpson's paradox. It was first observed in the first half of the last century. This is interesting because it was a large-scale case where it occurred, but it happens for real. And the issue in this case is that applying to sciences or arts is not uncorrelated with sex. So the science faculty is overall much easier to get into, or rather, it has fewer applicants per place. The arts faculty is much more heavily oversubscribed. So admission rate to sciences is 64%, admission rate to arts is 39%. This isn't necessarily because everybody wants to do arts and nobody wants to do sciences. It's also that the science faculty might be much better funded and have larger courses and more money to make them go, and so they can admit more people. Or it may just be that science is boring and no one wants to do it, one or the other. So science faculty accepts more people who apply. The arts faculty accepts fewer people, it is more highly contested. And men, by and large, apply to the science faculty, and women apply to the arts faculty. And this is not comprehensive. There's still lots of men applying to the arts faculty and several women applying to the science faculty. But by and large, there are more men applying for the science faculty than women, and more women applying to arts courses than men. And so women applying to the courses for which it is harder to get into, and men are applying for the courses which it is easy to get into. And so overall, so even though in both faculty groups they're accepting women preferentially to men, the overall result will be that men still get in because they're all attempting to do the sciences, and women don't because they're attempting to do the arts. So it's not direct. You can tell that the correlation is not causal at the selection level. The question is then, where is it? And the general hypothesis is something like this. You can break it down. You can begin to do causal analysis. You can say we have three things. We have gender. We have applying for arts or sciences, and we have success. We have admission, whether you get in or not. And the contention from the original table and that led to the course case was that your sex determined whether or not you got in. There was a direct causal link there. This kind of table suggests that actually whether or not you get in depends quite strongly on whether you're applying for an arts course or a science course, and that whether you apply for an arts course or a science course depends quite strongly on whether you're male or female. And one can then investigate reasons why this might be the case. You might want to investigate the different rates between faculties and ask, is that something that you're happy with? And this, the conjecture is that the application to arts or sciences is something that's an issue for high school education before, not necessarily just university admission, though again, it might be. It might be the impression they're giving on application, not on, on selection. So one can draw causal diagrams like that and then look for data to support each of these or not. But it's still worth being aware that when you see a table like this, and of course here, you might break these down further and discover that there is more going on in there. The same applies to, there's instances of this in health data where you can have medication, you can have treatments. You're comparing to treatment A and treatment B. There's an example on Wikipedia, which appears to be cited, so it seems genuine, of kidney stones, two treatments for kidney stones, one, and dividing people depending if they have large kidney stones or small kidney stones. And one treatment is better if you have large kidney stones, the other treatment is better if you have small kidney stones, but overall, one treatment is better if you have large kidney stones, the same treatment is better if you have small kidney stones, but the other treatment is better overall. So if you don't know how big your kidney stones are, go for one. If you know they're large or small, go for the other. It's confusing. And again, there are the treatments that work better if you're a man. Well, treatment A works better if you're a man. Treatment A works better if you're a man. Treatment A works better if you're a woman. But overall, treatment B works better. And what you have to do is look into these. Typically, this is where you have retrospective data, where whether somebody got treatment A or treatment B was affected by how ill they were, or whether a man or a woman, or whether they had larger or smaller kidney stones. So if, in the same way, applying to arts or sciences was influenced by somebody's sex. So if you have some data that's been collected, and it's not randomized, it's not blinded, we can't send people and say, go and apply to a science faculty, see if you get in. Then if you're just drawing from data that's already in a population, there may be other biases and correlations that you haven't looked for, or causality that you haven't looked for, that will affect the outcome you're actually getting. So this doesn't mean that chi-squared is of no use, but you need to very much be aware in the context in which it's being used. Okay, so that is, as far as I can tell, the end of my slides. Do please fill out the feedback sheet. This is notionally what you have the next 5 minutes to do. Fill it out, leave it on the side, or fill it out later and take it to the ITO, or do it online. Thanks very much for coming, and good luck with the exams. Just leave it on the side.